The Reverend Martin Luther King has been called perhaps the most inspirational speaker of all time. In August of 1963, he led the Great March on Washington, part of a demonstration that demanded voting rights, economic opportunity, and an end to segregation.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama, with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and singing the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Hello, and thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and coming up next, Scott Horton interviews Robert A. Pape and Adam Lankford, the two professors who are also authors, debate the root causes of suicide terrorism and whether it results from U.S. foreign policies and military occupations, or is it instead a manifestation of a personal mental health issues.
Anyway,
Let me stop you there. You've used as an example in the past Sri Lanka, where neither side is Muslim, and Sudan, where there's massive violence and everybody's Muslim, and there's no suicide terrorism in Sudan and plenty in Sri Lanka, to illustrate that point in the past. But I need to turn the mic over to Adam Langford here and let him get some words in. Although he's on the offensive and you're defending, I understand you need to try to draw out your points. But Adam, I want to ask you, it seems to me like, you know, to say that politics, it's just not about politics or something, kind of runs up against just the facts of, for example, Hezbollah and their long-term suicide campaign that ended as soon as the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon ended, right? Osama bin Laden never blew himself up, but the guys that he recruited to blow themselves up, he recruited with a bunch of shtick about how America occupies the Holy Peninsula, et cetera, supports Israel, right?
Well, there's no doubt that terrorist propaganda uses religion, and it uses foreign occupation, and it uses, you know, political arguments. You know, terrorist propaganda has a whole bunch of stuff in it. What I would say is, you know, if you simply believe what the terrorists say, you know, it's going to lead you astray. You're falling for that propaganda.
I think the question is, what do the volunteer suicide bombers believe? Not whether we believe Osama bin Laden is an honest guy. He's obviously a lying, murdering manipulator. But what he's telling his recruits is that this is about politics. And he cites Israel and the Arabian Peninsula and the blockade against Iraq of the 1990s, et cetera, like that. In fact, in The Looming Tower, Lawrence Wright says that Mohammed Atta filled out his last will and testament when Israel reinvaded southern Lebanon and did Operation Grapes of Wrath in 1996, which also takes up, you know, four or five paragraphs, I think, in bin Laden's original fatwa of 96.
Well, what I would say is you're absolutely right about the terrorist leaders, and you're absolutely right about the terrorists, but you're not right about the suicide terrorists. Suicide terrorists, far and away are individuals who were not politically very active, and then something goes wrong in their life. Unwanted pregnancy, divorce, other sort of family problems. They get sick. They have a disability. They have someone in their family dies. All of a sudden, they have a crisis, and that's what actually leads them to want to die and kill. Now, certainly, you know, overall, would they prefer that Islamic fundamentalist forces win? Sure, they would, but it's not their primary goal. It's really, you know, just like Dr. Pape himself would admit that religion's not the primary goal.
Scott, I would just simply ask your listeners to reflect on the type of family crises that Adam has just laid out, and to ask, don't they already know people in their lives who fit that description? And don't they, and isn't it the case that this is simply true of many hundreds of millions of people, of the 6.5 billion people on our planet?
Yeah, I think we've heard that argument
before.
That's
true. If this really is true, then we should basically see suicide terrorism as a pretty constant factor, not ebbing and flowing with respect to foreign occupation, as you just pointed out with Lebanon and as our work shows in many other cases, but basically as a constant factor around the planet. And that's just not what we see.
Let me respond to that. It's just so clear that when you're talking, you don't understand what suicidal people are like. When you act like, you know, they're just kind of going to walk around in a daze and crying, you know, there are millions of families who didn't see any of those kind of signs, and then their family member killed themselves. Now, when it comes to the problems I mentioned, what about cases of murder-suicide? That's one of the things I've done. I've paralleled the lives of people who commit suicide terrorism with the lives of people who can commit murder-suicide in places just like the U.S. Now, some people commit murder-suicide in the U.S. because they get fired from their jobs. It's a fact. It's not debatable. It's a fact. They get fired. The next day, they go into work, and they start shooting. What you could say with your kind of logic here is, if that was true, everyone who gets fired from a job would then go in and commit an act of murder-suicide. It's just not true. Some people do, and some people don't. Certainly, there are individual differences.
But that's the perfect example, Adam, which is that, let's say, as many as 3% of the people who get fired from their job go out and commit murder-suicide.
That's an absurdly high number, by the way. Okay.
Right. That's my point. My point is not that I'm denying that happens. What you're claiming is that that's the dominant feature of suicide terrorists, which means it must characterize the vast majority. And what I'm telling you is that, in fact, it just simply doesn't hold up. If it did, we would see it pretty much at a steady state. Now, what we could argue about the level of that state, but pretty much as a steady state in pretty much every country in the world. And we just simply don't see that. And I would also just point out that, let's just sort of kind of get into the details. I'm not claiming that every ordinary suicide went through these bouts of crying or went through, but in fact, about 50%, if you go and look at the literature, the clinical literature on ordinary suicide, you'll discover that about half of all those people who commit suicide, ordinary suicide, have been hospitalized for clinical depression, where these are the hard indicators that led to their hospitalization. Then they were released, and then they went, after multiple attempts at committing suicide, actually succeeding. Now, of course, there are some that don't fit that profile, but what I'm trying to tell you is you're taking essentially 2 or 3% of the sample and trying to extend this over all of the group, and it's just simply not correct.
Adam, it seems to me, I read a book called Perfect Soldiers by a L.A. Times reporter named Terry McDermott. It was primarily concerned with the Hamburg cell, the muscle hijackers that were brought in toward the end. Nobody knows as much about them, but this guy wrote the biography, basically, of the Hamburg cell, and those guys didn't seem like they were all suicidal to me. They all had pretty good lives going on, and there's one, I believe, is Marwan al-Shehhi, is portrayed as always going back and forth. He's got a wife and a family going on that he's dedicated to, and yet on the other hand, he's a soldier dedicated to this mission. It's not that he wanted to end his life. He, in fact, I think, risked the mission by traveling back to Europe to see his wife one last time and things like this. And the whole group of them, none of them are portrayed as, wanting to die and now they just want to go out in a blaze of glory at all. They all seem to, they wanted to go fight against the Russians, or they wanted to go fight against, some imperialist force encroaching on Muslim land one way or the other, and they got recruited into this game, you know?
Yeah, well, I see what you're saying, but frankly, that's not my reading of the evidence, even portrayed in that book, Perfect Soldiers. If you look at Muhammad Atta, I mean, even other Islamic fundamentalists in Germany thought Muhammad Atta stood out as abnormal, and they were right. He was so lonely and bitter. I mean, there are a remarkable number of things in his life which help explain why he would have become suicidal. Now, suicide's not a simple thing, and certainly there are a lot of factors in there.
Well, and organizing the takeover of 4 planes and crashing them into high-profile targets on the East Coast is no simple thing either.
Right, but the point is, that's a fundamental misunderstanding of suicide. Suicidal people can be completely rational, they can plan things out. I mean, look at the Columbine attacks. The kids who carried out the Columbine attacks, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, they put a tremendous amount of planning. They were planning that attack for more than a year. They planted bombs, they planted extra bombs, they wrote long notes, and then they shot themselves in the head. So just because you're suicidal and you're set on murder-suicide doesn't mean you can't act rationally and carry out what seems to be a very strategic plan.
Again, I think that I just encourage those listening to accept that Adam's right probably about 3 or 4% of the time. That if he was right even more than 50% of the time, we just simply wouldn't see suicide terrorism rise when we have foreign occupations and decline when we don't. The other thing I'd like to add, though, is that occupation itself can be a cause of mental illness. There's a great book written called The Wretched of the Earth by Fanon. This is a book that was written about the French occupation of Algeria during the Cold War. So it's an old book. But I'd ask your listeners to go and check this book out, because they often don't see the whole second half of the book, which is called Mental Illness, where there's profile after profile, detailed profile after detailed profile, of how the occupation itself, in various specifically different micro ways, produces what we've come to think is mental illness. But the root is the occupation itself, which is why we do see in some occupations, we do see some mental illness. It does tend to come, and this has been something we've known now for really 40-some years.
Well, actually, and you just look at all the PTSD among the soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan and think what it's like for the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, the civilians in these war zones.
Exactly.
That's actually somewhere where we agree, Scott. You know, in fact, I sent a note to Dr. Paif about, you know, 8 or 9 months ago, basically saying that thing, that his foreign occupation thesis makes the most sense when you look at foreign occupation as a cause of things like mental illness and suicidal behavior. You know, but again, it's the difference between saying the political ideology, you know, people don't get mad, walk up to a terrorist recruiter and say, I want to martyr myself. They do get mad and walk up to a terrorist recruiter and say, I want to fight. But if, you know, if somebody drops a bomb on your family members, that may cause you to become suicidal. So that is something we agree on.
And leave it right there. Thanks very much to both of you.
Really. Thank you, gentlemen.
Glad to do it. Okay, right. Bye.
Everybody, that is Adam Lankford from the University of Alabama and Robert A. Paip from the University of Chicago.
King or beast with quite so little hair.
I'm gonna be the main event like no king was before. I'm brushing up on looking down. I'm working on my
board. Thus far, rather an inspiring thing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
You've run a long way to go, young master, if you think.
No one's saying do this.
Now, when I said that,
no one's saying be there.
What?
No one's saying stop that. No one
thinks
seeing him.
Now see him.
He don't run around all day.
Well, that's definitely out.
Freedom to it all my way.
I think it's time that you and I arranged a heart-to-heart.
Kings don't need advice from little hornbills for a start.
If this is where the monarchy is headed, count me out. Out of service, out of Africa, I wouldn't hang about. This child is getting wildly out of wing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king. Everybody look left, everybody look right. Where you look, I'm standing spotlight.
Not yet.
Let the green shoot of the broken sea. Let's hear the Hindenburg on the wing. It's gonna be decent.
Hello, and thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and coming up next is Scott Horton interviewing Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is an independent historian and journalist for IPS News, and he discusses the 20-year U.S. campaign of death and destruction in Iraq. He also talks about how Nouri al-Maliki tricked the Bush administration into negotiating a troop withdrawal deadline, and why the gigantic U.S. embassy is destined to become a museum of U.S. atrocities.
It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. On the line is Gareth Porter from Interpress Service. We run it all at antiwar.com/Porter. Welcome back, Gareth. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks again.
Very happy to have you. All right. So, look, here, yesterday when the interview was ruined by the dang commercial break and we had to go, we left off right around the spot where Ahmed Chalabi was an Iranian spy sent to tell the Israeli Fifth Column in the United States that he was going to create a wonderful democracy that would be in alliance with Israel. And because Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney are the stupidest men in the whole wide world, they fell for it. And now here we are 8 years later, and the Dawa Party and Muqtada al-Sadr and his guys rule Iraq from Baghdad to Basra, and they're kicking the Americans out. And you were going, and we were right at the part where Nouri al-Maliki, you said, I believe your words were, played the Americans. And this is my favorite part of the story, if I understand it right. So
I was going to very briefly outline the evidence that al-Maliki actually tricked the Bush administration into negotiating with the Iraqi government about the withdrawal of U.S. troops. I mean, he did so. He started talking about this in the summer of 2007. He sent his national security advisor, al-Rubai, to I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly, for which I apologize. But he sent him to Washington to talk with high-level officials, and part of what he presented, what he pitched to the White House and others in Washington at that point, was the idea that they should negotiate a SOFA, Status of Forces Agreement, so that the Americans could remain in Iraq, so that the Iraqis would be certain that they would have an American military presence. And of course, this was the come on that they were soothing the Bush administration belief that that certainly their desire to have a long term military presence in Iraq, and suggesting that this was the way to do it. There's absolute good reason to believe that the Iraqis had already had the idea that they wanted to get the U.S. to withdraw on a timetable. For one thing, as early as 2006, one of the first things that al-Maliki did was to talk about a timetable for withdrawal, and that was quickly knocked down by the Bush administration. They said absolutely not, and it was then sort of there was no discussion about it. But there's very good reason to believe that when he sent this envoy to Washington in 2007 to try to get them interested in negotiating a SOFA, that's what he had in mind all along. And as I said, I think in the first part of our discussion about this, the Bush administration was taken completely by surprise in 2008 when in July, for the first time, al-Maliki demanded the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces. And, of course, in July and August, the Bush administration was sort of trying to dismiss that, saying that wasn't really the Iraqi position, that, in fact, they were talking about notional time frames, but that there was no hard and fast deadline for withdrawal that was being discussed. All along, of course, they knew that, in fact, that was exactly what al-Maliki had demanded, and we know the final result. So I think that the evidence strongly supports the idea that al-Maliki, with obviously full support of Muqtada al-Sadr and of the Iranians, was planning to get the United States military out of there over a period of time. I think that, you know, he was flexible about exactly what the time frame would be, but the important thing was to get the U.S. committed to a timetable for withdrawal, and he succeeded in doing that.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now
Hey!
great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now for something completely different.